Episode one of.
And Kelly, just you're you
scooched. I scooched. Back. I scooched. I just wanna be closer to you. It feels organic to be an inch to the left.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel that.
Yeah.
Imagine that you are an inch to the left already. Ooh. You know?
I am not only my body. But I'm in a body.
Right. And which is fun, honestly.
Is it always fun for you being in a body?
Sometimes the minutia of being in a body can be not so great, but I think generally it is fun to be in a body because you get to go through the ups and downs of a body, of it being fun and not fun. So there's like a grander, greater funness, I guess, happening above the little funs that you get to have. Yeah.
How did you learn to make it fun?
I don't think we learn. I think like we do that as kids. Like life is fun as kids. Because there's no responsibility. You're safe. I mean, I'm speaking to the, I guess, majority of children. Actually, maybe not the majority of children. But to more privileged children, a more privileged upbringing. Even if you were like abused in your own ways. We've all been abused in different ways because our parents make mistakes and they were also people. And in my case, people younger than me giving up their lives and never having the opportunity to figure out who they are or to live out their dreams because they had to raise children, get married, flee from the war. Stop school because school's closed. What were we talking about?
Well, I was finding a pathway into introducing the show.
Right.
Welcome, viewers. Thank you for being here. And I was up in my mind. I was trying to have this experience in my body, listening to you and being attentive and being present. Mm-hmm. But my mind was running off and wanting to introduce you properly. And where I went was, can I pronounce her name without messing it up? And maybe you get this a lot, but you're from Lebanon. Mm-hmm. You grew up in Canada partly and in Lebanon partly. Mm-hmm. And so you're sharing these different worlds. Mm-hmm. Right now you're known as Twitchy Witch.
Twitchy Witch.
And there's kind of an embedded, there's a misspelling, actually. This is interesting. Mm-hmm. On TikTok, Twitchy isn't spelled the way that we commonly spell it, or the way that the rules say we're supposed to spell it.
Twitchy.
So you put this little glitch in your name. Mm-hmm.
Well, because it's, I wanted it to glitch, because then it'd be glitchy, like Twitchy, but I kind of had to because somebody had already taken Twitchy Witch and then Twitchy.witch, so I was kind of left with having to play. It was going to be either Twitchy with an X instead of an I or T-Witchy, and I prefer T-Witchy because a way we make like jokes in Arabic is using an Arabic dialect to speak English, and you'll split up the consonants. So, masalan, beach, or yeah, beach would be like bitish because it has that. The hard ch, which is the, yeah.
That makes sense because Arabic is built differently than English, the way the alphabet is connected. And so when you speak in English, it's like kind of this like static broken up experience.
Oh yeah, we were talking about that yesterday. Like even the way it's written, like it's, the letters are all continuous, like as if you were always writing in cursive. Whereas like in English, we don't write in cursive. Not just English, I think Latin languages, even Greek, probably in most languages, now that I think about it. Whereas Arabic is very continuous, and it kind of mirrors, I think, the melodic sound. It's very poetic language. What was the question? ADD is strong today.
I don't know if there was a question. So for those of you who don't know Twitchy Witch, her name, her, one of her other names, she goes by many perhaps, is Elian El Amuni. Did I say that right?
Yeah, yeah. Elian El Amuni.
Elian El Amuni.
Yes, beautiful. Amazing. Tap into the French Canadian within you. You
know? Elian.
Wait, that was that... okay, that was good.
It was something.
Yeah.
You never know when you go for the accent what's going to come out. But she's a TikTok superstar.
Superstar.
A PhD candidate, an author, and a poet.
Yes, ma'am.
And sometimes a cat.
Most importantly.
I've been meaning to ask you about this because when I found you on TikTok, you have your little spiel, which is so smart. You like you have the hook and then you introduce yourself and you go into the bulk as the, you know, the algorithm goes. And you always end the introduction with, and sometimes I'm a cat.
Yeah, just a little playfulness.
I was like, no, I'm on board. Like, obviously, she's sometimes a cat. Like, that's the height of alchemy is transfiguration. Okay. So,
I mean, what are you sometimes? What do you turn into?
A seal, I think. Maybe a dog. I just feel akin to dogs. I'm like, we're not separate. When we're together, I am. Like, we're just this, like, symbiotic bubble of joy.
Oh, I love that. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So you're a puppy sometimes.
I think so.
I'd love that. That's so cute.
So one of the roles, PhD candidate, and you're almost done defending.
Yeah, I've been almost done for a little while. But yeah.
Yeah, it's a long process. And I can imagine especially creating an argument, like that's the purpose, right? You're delivering a message that hasn't been said before. And so to take the time to reflect, and how has it changed from when you went in to what was your intention going in to argue, and where did it land now?
That's a great question. Because I started when I came for my PhD, I had applied to write about Gibran, the person who wrote The Prophet, and his influence on American literature, specifically like beatnik literature. And then I took this cultural politics course, and I did a final project. And through the final project, I found this whole subculture of young Palestinians who were writing this very politically charged, very smart, very good hip-hop. And from there, I found this whole music scene, like, of trance and trap and techno and a full underground scene. And then this scene, I realized, was also connected to queerdom and queer activism happening in Palestine. And within that, there was like this cultural bridge being built among all of these different, like, disparate Palestinian communities, like within the historic homeland. So West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, Haifa, Lid, like all over. Whereas, you know, they're all living under occupation. They're all separated. It's like this, it's like a forced ethnic division, like in a sense. And I guess that's the way generally settler colonialism and these systems have rooted and imposed themselves. They'll come to the land and separate the communities so that they're no longer able to like communicate with each other. There's no more back and forth. They can't travel towards one another. They're all dealing with like this threat to their existence. And then to find amidst all of that this very lively, thriving musical community talking about liberation, very politically aware, very smart, like all also doing activist work and protesting and petitioning, and it's just very beautiful. And I was like, okay, this is what I'm going to study. Like, khalas, I think I've done enough, like, literature, philosophy, beatnik, etc. And yeah, that was it. That's where it started, and then this is where it came up. So I wanted to argue in the beginning that this is a real subculture, a political subculture, but I found out that this has already kind of been talked about in the literature. So in doing research, I also found very beautifully that in academia, there was already also a heightened awareness of Palestine, Palestinian studies, which I wasn't aware of at all because I wasn't into post-colonialism or political literature, etc. I was into a more dreamscape, alchemical poetry. All later I realized, like what I was very immersed in, was largely the literature of empire, like English literature and French literature. But anyways, yeah, there's a lot of awareness in academia about Palestine, and there are lots of studies being done and lots is being documented, which is really great because it's so important. That's the most important thing. That's part of how these traditions and cultures and nations and peoples get lost, because their literature is lost, their story is lost. So to see lots of people all over in academia, all from all over the world, telling their stories and arguing for their cause and picking apart the Zionist regime and connecting it to a heritage of colonialism is really beautiful. But then it made my job more difficult, because what am I going to argue now? And in that, I found a whole bunch of little arguments to make, because so much has been said. But
well, I, as you were talking, I was thinking about how empire bans has banned music in certain countries, and like when Canada was colonized, the traditions were banned and the gatherings were banned. Mm-hmm. and that's how you oppress people. Mm-hmm. But then what's born out of that is these new kinds of creativity and these new kinds of expression, or the, like these dynamic reactions to being colonized, mm-hmm. and how it evolves art and creativity, mm-hmm. in such horrific circumstances. Yeah. But it's, I can imagine it's difficult for you to talk about the work, because growing up in Lebanon, you were so close to Palestine, mm-hmm. and you submitted your dissertation on October 6th.
Yeah. That was a good time.
And then since then, you've been continuing to do the work and continuing to participate in academia, but seeing that, like, that is not the place where change is happening. Mm-hmm. And then you just gave a talk on the dream space, mm-hmm. and what it means to be, what it does to the dream space living under occupation. Mm-hmm. And you're someone who works in the dream space, mm-hmm. who's had a lifetime of experience in the dream space and has been taught how to navigate it. So I can't imagine how difficult it is for you to hold all of this and be doing this work and advocating for people while also holding all of the pain and the grief of that.
Oh, yeah, thanks. So, I mean, we get to do the easy part, and I'm only holding the awareness, you know, of it all. I don't have to be living it. That in itself gave me, I guess, the impetus to want to study and talk about it. Because, I mean, we're all just kind of standing around.
But most people can't even hold the awareness.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And especially, I think that's especially the case here in North America. People in North America generally, I think right now, are feeling for the first time the weight, especially people who are empathetic, who really can feel the pain of others and imagine what it is to be in their condition or in their place. And they're just now, for the first time, really being opened up by the kind of reality that people in the Middle East live in every day. Like, you're opened up in that way from birth, because like I was saying, like, a bomb falling on Beirut is not out of the realm of possibility. It's one of the more possible things that could happen. Whereas a bomb falling on Vancouver, or a bomb falling on LA, and all, of course, like, it's, you can't even imagine it. But for the people who are seeing it, who are seeing people living, and there are bombs falling from the sky, and you never know when you can die, and really feeling that, being so close to death, having death be so imminent and casual around you, is scary. Like, that's so overwhelming to just find out, especially as an adult. You know, when you grow up in it, I think it's like the trauma is like more wired in. So, like, I think a lot of people now, like me, who are Arab American, Arab Canadian, or even just even African American, or most people from the global south, I think at this point, are watching the rest, watching North Americans wake up and really validate our grief in a weird way. And it's like, now we are allowed the space now to grieve Palestine and talk about Palestine so openly, because North American colonial peoples are also waking up to it and grieving it. Which is also why I think a lot of people, a lot of activists get so upset about neutrals, about white feminists, about white spiritual creators not speaking up, not saying anything. Ma, we're all only able to speak up when you speak up, unfortunately. That's the system, and you need to be the ones to lead the dismantling of the system. Mm. You have to dismantle it, in a way. But you are, I think. There are people like you. There are more people like you that I'm meeting. Like us, Yane.
I think it's easy to get caught up in the individualism, though. Like, that's something I struggle with. Or I've struggled with, because I have strong impulses to help, but then I get burnt out and I go, well, like, is it, and you see that it's not working, or that it's not working fast enough, because every time people gather and stand up for something, that's amazing. That's what it's about. It's in that moment, it's happening, you know, but then you look and you're like, the policies haven't changed. That our government is still not taking right action. We're still sending arms to Israel. How do we stop this? And so, like, when you don't carry the weight of knowing it in your body, of having lived with it, you can bypass, you can turn it off. And I think that's, like, a lot, New Age spirituality is cut off from a part of our souls with that fear of death, that inability to be okay with death, the drive for immortality in this sense. I think that, like, oh, we're ascending, or like, we're moving to 5D, as some people say, and you're like, no, we're in human bodies. That's the point. Suffering exists, and we try to make it better. It's pretty simple.
Yeah. The individualist only understands suffering when they are the ones suffering. So, like, if we were in the group with the bully, there's a group of us and there was a bully, the most effective thing would be to, for all of us to not accept the behavior, confront the bully, they either integrate and apologize, or they leave the group and we all continue. But because not everyone in the group will be a collectivist, there will be some individualists, and the collectivism will not be able to fully form, fully actualize. We'll all split off. There'll be the people fighting the bully, confronting the bully, the people being neutral, empowering the bully to continue to fight with us and argue with us, since they're not really being blamed, or their right is kind of being protected by the neutrality, essentially. And either the group will fall apart, the collectivists will leave, and the neutrals and the bully will remain together in their own little bubble, and the rest will leave and be in their own little bubble. And I wonder if that's what we're moving towards, separation, because there's been this unilateral power that the United States has had since the 90s, since like 91, since the fall of the Soviet Union. So there's this like hegemonic dispersion of America, America, the dollar, everywhere. And with the Eastern powers like Russia and China, etc., all kind of conglomerating into a sort of alliance, starting in their own financial, the currency. That split that's happening, whether that will manifest on the ground between those of us now who want to topple the system and those of us who want to maintain and, you know, try to do just fix moving forward. And by fix, I mean changing the names, essentially, of what we're doing. Like the Indigenous Act that was the Indian Act that really just in policy and in action pretty much was the same, but it wasn't called the Indian Act anymore. It's now the Indigenous Act. It sounds better, so it must be better.
That the way that we shift language, yeah, and it's, we were talking about this, that, you know, the Indian Act got put in place, and then it was, you know, the Indian Affairs, this is how it's run, and that's how people were referred to. Mm-hmm. And then we realized, you're like, okay, well, this is a problem. Wait, actually, what we're doing here is there's something wrong. Like, a consciousness came through, like, colonization wasn't completed. You know, the genocide of Indigenous peoples in Canada, it wasn't successful. They tried. But the resiliency of the people held, and the land held, and then people came into a higher consciousness and realized, like, oh, this isn't so great. But they actually didn't change the Indian Act policies. They just changed the names. And that's the kind of trick of the political correct culture, where we think we're doing something better, but not changing the underlying policies. It's kind of like, okay, we've created a politer language, a better language that doesn't refer to the initial acts of horror. We've softened that, but the policies are still in place, and we're still, like Wet'suwet'en, for example, just north of here, they won in court that their land is theirs. You know, the territory was never ceded, no documents were signed, the land is theirs, and they won that in a provincial court of law. So by the rules, they won, and still the resource extraction is happening, still the RCMP are going in there and terrorizing people and arresting them. And
of course. Well, the justice system is a joke. It's not a justice system, it's a justifying system. It's only to justify the actions of the people who wrote the system. I mean, the ICJ trials are really showing us that. It's so crazy to me that we actually need that to happen. This is the kind of world we live in. And Jed, if you look at it like if you were an alien watching this as like part of a series or a show, like, are they really like dressing up in suits and just meeting and standing behind bureaus and blah 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 blah, blah, Your Honor, blah blah blah, Hamas, blah blah blah, Your Honor, Hamas. This is real. Like, this is real. It kind of blows my mind sometimes.
They're just playing dress up. It's a mockery while people are starving.
Yeah, while people...
While they're being bombed, while Empire is just like, yep, we're just going to keep mowing it down. Mm-hmm. We're just going to keep dominating. Like, mm-hmm. And meanwhile, oh gosh, that...
is. It's crazy.
And then we get these tiny little incremental changes. Mm-hmm. Like, I think Canada is reinstating the UNRWA funding. They're like, mm-hmm. oh, yeah, we'll give it back. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, people are like, oh, you're like, is it really? Because was that system working before? Or is that another corrupt system that is like maybe the best system that we can see, mm-hmm. but it's not a real system. It's not a humane system. Mm-hmm. It's not one based on actual justice. Which I'm not even sure what actual justice is at this point.
Yeah. Well, one of the cards we got when we were pulling for topics was integrity. And there's no integrity in the justice system. There's no... Our leaders don't have integrity. The law applies only if... Or I guess the law doesn't apply when you are of the people who wrote it, essentially. So, like, the fact, Masana, to me, last year, Donald Trump, everyone was talking about how he's going to run for president still, right? And everybody's, like, worried about Trump running for president. That's not the problem. The problem is that, like, it's even a possibility, like, this person, this is a criminal. They're just running around. If any one of you did 10%, 1% of what Donald Trump has done, you'd be in prison. Why isn't he in prison? Mish, he's worse than Biden. Don't vote for Trump. Like, that's not, no one should be worrying about. Everyone should be worrying about how is this person allowed to run? How are any of them allowed to run?
Honestly, the fact that, I mean, he was already president, like he got in, mm-hmm. and I feel like humans are so good at normalizing, you know, because we're put in these little boxes and we have to earn, we have to make money to stay alive and often at jobs that are not aligned with our passions mm-hmm. and it's stressful. And of course, everything's inflating. And so we just have to normalize because we have to keep going. Mm-hmm. And so someone like, as you see that the system is corrupt, someone like Trump gets in and you're like, oh, wait, maybe it's been corrupt this whole time and it's a system that doesn't work and it's not a real democracy. Mm-hmm. I can't really fix it. I mean, like, there are these pathways that people say you can take. You can run yourself for politics or you can advocate for alternative types of politics, but like there's no momentum there. Like, no one's changing anything. Mm-hmm. And so you just kind of shut down and normalize. Mm-hmm. And I think it creates a big disconnect for people. And it's interesting hearing you talk about like a separation happening of worlds, because I feel like we can be so separated in our minds because reality has just become like distortions and like it's surreal and we can see the corruption on the surface and more people now see it. Mm. And it's very plain and obvious once you see it. But you feel trapped in it. And so I think as a regulating tool, we normalize to it and we just go, okay, well, like Trump's running again. And like, but then there's this underlying fear or anxiety or maybe hope of like, well, this has to change and be different because this is ludicrous and out of control.
And I guess it's also frustrating for us and the younger generation, like Gen Z, who are really politically active and really smart, which is so great to see. Frustrating for us, feeling like there's nothing we can do, like, to actually make it stop. Because, you know, clearly voting isn't the answer. And petitioning and protesting and all these things that we do that are so mild and that don't, like... that make us feel empowered but don't really threaten the system in any way. But it is more difficult today to do things that do threaten the system or be able to reach the people in power than it was, say, in the late 1700s when the French king and queen were hung, which was like a really powerful moment for people, for humanity. But that's a lot more difficult today And what we do have access to is our voice. And ultimately, continuing to talk about it, continuing to tell the stories, continuing to educate ourselves, to burn it into our minds, to write it into history books, that is what, in the long run, I believe, will help us the most, until we've actually reached positions where we can make more palpable differences. Because, like the Charlie Chaplin speech, and the Great Dictator, like he says, you know, as long as men die, liberty will never perish. Like, kings die, leaders die, new people replace them. People from our generation, the younger generation, in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, they'll be in better and better places. In 10, 20, 30, 40 years, Trump will be dead. Biden will be dead. Nabih Bedri will be dead. If there are any Lebanese people watching, that's like a... This man is supposed to be... The conspiracy is that he's an immortal lizard person, but... Whole other thing. That man has been in power for like 60 years or something. It's insane. But, yeah. We'll get there. We'll get to the places. And as long as we keep talking, educating ourselves, educating each other, sharing stories, building, learning, being better, everything will be better because we're being better.
I'm here for that. Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like alchemy is the practice of being better, right? Like, that's the whole thing that you teach is how to open up your awareness and how to get comfortable with death, or to die while you're alive again and again. And it feels like more and more people are becoming open to that. And even just like, 5 years ago, astrology was still kind of an underground thing. And now it couldn't be more mainstream and popular. Like I know men who 5 years ago would just laugh at it. And now, like, even if they don't believe it, they'll pretend just to keep getting laid. Like,
love that.
You're like, oh, it's hit the mainstream. And it's just like these different ways of perceiving the world and being with the world and other types of intelligences. Because again, the English is just like so sectioned and broken off, and we're put in our boxes and we're kept separate. And then we're taught to hunt for love and to like, we have to validate ourselves and you have to go out and you have to, like, especially as women, it's like, go be an independent woman. Like, go get it all done. And you're like, okay, but also like, this isn't working and I'm striving so hard and like, I'm not getting the love, like my needs met, and I'm doing it the way they told me to do it, but it's not working. And the whole, the boxed off, I don't know. I struggle with this, like the whole like white picket fence, monogamy, family. You're like, is that a facet of empire? Is that where empire has led us? And maybe we're, but then at the same time, like we evolve as we go, right? Like you can't go back. And so we're being invited to build something new on, the bones of empire, the compost of empire, that looks different about how we live and how we show up. And I know you have such a dynamic perspective from growing up in two different places and living in two different cultures. And we've been talking about the differences between how the gender roles are in Lebanon versus Canada. And I think I've been telling Twitchy that her dating advice is... Literally, we need to do a Twitchy show because I know so many women who are looking for partners and just feeling like men aren't stepping up. And I've been talking to them and really trying, and talking to myself, trying to reframe it. It's just like, well, maybe there's no room for them to step up. Maybe there's a way that we're striving too much, that like under this, you know, capitalistic system where it's like everyone, we want everyone's labor. Oh, like feminist movement, we can twist this. Yeah, we want your labor too. Let's go.
I think that the way it connects with death is that, like, in this, like, love and death are interconnected, in fact, right? So they, where we are in Lebanon, in the Middle East, in the Global South, I think, like I said, death is imminent. Death is likely. Different kinds of death are all likely. You live with them every day. Whereas here, there is a denial in that death because it's not imminent. There's no reason for you to imagine that anything would go wrong in Vancouver, anyone would attack Vancouver, or anyone would attack Los Angeles, etc. So, because no one feels the imminence of death, there's no urgency to live, to really play, to laugh, to have good times, to cry, to get angry, to really, like, live out passionately. So I feel that people around the world, like, we all, people say that, like, we're more heated, browner people are more heated, and it's, I think it's more so that people are generally more alive when they live in places where war is common, where death is possible, where you could be bombarded. Knowing that just raises the lust for life, I believe. Just expands it in so many ways. So when it comes to love, the outcome of what we want from our relationships and what we want from our lives is ultimately different when death is imminent and when death is not imminent. When death is imminent, you want the best situations. You want to figure out the best dynamic. You want to play around with it. You want to figure it out before the time is up, in case the time is up, in a sense. Whereas where we are here, because we're so safe and comfortable, and there just keeps, there's just more and more every day, and more is built, and more companies, and more industry, and more products, more technology, etc. We also need more labor. So instead of leaving people to live out their relationships for the sake of love, for the sake of brotherhood, in a sense, even charity, community, relationships become networks, become places of transaction, because even in our everyday, the things we do are part of, like, our transaction. We go to our job because we want to make that money so that we can survive and also spend our money on all the beautiful things that the people we're working for are selling us. And so we're always in this loop. So everything outside of the loop too, it's like, how do I keep it? How do I keep it at net zero at least, or profit a little bit from my relationships, from my interactions, from the people in my life? So even in dating, it becomes like women and men are becoming so transactional. What do you bring to the table? What do I bring to the table? What do you bring to the table? Like, could y'all just sit at the table, like, and just let a waiter bring you some food and not worry about who's bringing what, and just, like, meet each other? Like, just, like, who is this person? Forget the table.
Like, I have this list of boxes that I need you to check, so I'd like to go through them as quickly as possible, and I can move on to the next one.
Yeah. These are the things I need from a person in this position. It's like a job, essentially. Yeah,
and I'm on this timeline, and, like,
I don't think it's just women. I think men and women, just because of the way the system is set up and the way people are caught into it. So it has to be this way. Like, we have energy reserves. My energy is limited. Anna, I can't, give this more than this much amount of energy to this, and I'm going to need from you this amount of energy in this way, and that way we can be good. essentially. But yeah, I think, and that's what then creates these dynamics in relationships that are out of balance. Like the people themselves love each other. A lot of the time they don't even know each other that well, but they do love what they know. Mm-hmm. But they just can't, it's like they don't know how to communicate it, or they think they're not supposed to communicate it, actually. Mm. I think people like unconsciously will withhold their love, withhold their feelings for the rationality of, well, did you do this thing for me? Are you doing this thing for me? How many times do I have to tell you about the things that I want done for me? Rather than moving in love to let your partner know what you want to be loved, what you desire in your love. And sometimes you don't do that with words, with all of the words. Sometimes you do it with an action. Sometimes you do it with a joke.
But you allow it to flow naturally. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not outcome-based. There's not this sort of like, well, I need this to fulfill me. Because you're like, I'm good. Mm-hmm. I'm good. Like, everything that comes for me is like, this is a bonus. This mm-hmm. is great. It's not like I need you to do these things for me to be okay. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm set. And then it's all open and available from there. Like, we're taught to clench, and we're taught to push mm-hmm. and to strive and to grasp and to like earn what's ours or demand what's ours mm-hmm. instead of receiving, letting it be. Mm-hmm. And I'm so astounded by the thought of it's our comfort that leads to our dissatisfaction. Mm-hmm. Like, it's our comfort that keeps us, you know, seeking this perfection instead of just being with what's present and being present with what's present. Mm. And it's interesting because in the West, especially here in Canada and Vancouver, is a very safe place. Mm-hmm. And we have comfort, and it's not even the illusion of comfort. A lot of people here have lived their whole lives in comfort. But I think that only comes at the expense of someone somewhere else. Mm. Like, we know most of the clothes you buy in stores, a lot of the food products, you know, someone's being exploited. Mm-hmm. And so we have all of this access to comfort. It makes many of us dissatisfied, especially our generation now, because we're like, wait, we don't want this, mm-hmm. but we're stuck in this sort of wheel. So how do we get out? And it feels like we have to push more. It feels like we have to grasp more. It feels like we have to control more because that's what the system is telling us. When actually, like, yeah, in love and dating, but in all things, mm-hmm. there is this invitation to relax mm-hmm. and to get into alignment with ourselves and to get regulated before we take action. But we're so tricked into thinking that the doing is going to lead to the success. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, if I just work harder, it's like, yeah, they're just going to keep raising food costs, mm-hmm. you know, oh, I just made a bit more. It's like, no, we need a new economic system. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe we need a different relationship to currency.
Mm. Or like, maybe we need to stop burning food, perfectly good food, just being burnt to keep prices high, to help prices rise.
It's like, should food be for profit at all? Like, maybe people shouldn't profit off of basic human rights. I don't know.
Right. It's another one of those weird dystopic things, like the earth is so abundant, you could turn one tomato into a handful of tomatoes by putting it in the earth. That's insane. Like, that's actual magic, and we don't even realize it. It doesn't ask you for anything. If you have a tomato, the earth wants nothing else from you. Just put that tomato in the ground and see what happens. You'll get 5 tomatoes. And then from those 5 tomatoes, like, what?
Jesus over here, just multiplying.
Legit. Legit. And then, yeah. I don't know, like, again, in no, like in the French when the French Revolution happened, and the king and queen were beheaded, there was a void. What always happens with revolution, if it partially succeeds in bringing down the old order, it creates a vacuum, and the vacuum can be filled by something worse, something similar with a different face. Yeah, they took down the king and queen, but then Napoleon became dictator. So is it really that different? Like,
has any revolution succeeded?
Right.
Like, maybe revolution, maybe it's like, how do we evolve differently? It's interesting, revolution, evolution. Mm. Evolution, you stick an R on it. What does that do? This little spell of like, oh yes, you can revolt and you will have success. It's like, is that just what empire tells us? Mm. It's like it's empire's way of kind of like manifesting itself in a different iteration. And it's like, no, we got to take a hard left turn. We got to go somewhere else. Mm. But that's not to say that like that protest doesn't work again. It's like every time people come together and stand up for something, like that moves the consciousness. Mm-hmm. And I think people don't even show up at protests because they feel like it's, because they're so outcome based. They go like, well, I don't think my body on the street will do anything, so I'm not going to go. Mm-hmm. When it's like, yeah, your body on the street might not change policy, but like it's going to change how you feel by being in that space and being around those people and like holding that in your heart. Mm-hmm. That's going to move the consciousness. Like, we can't be married to these linear actions, even though we do take them. Because mm-hmm. entropy is real.
Right. It's there. It's happening. It's the entropy itself that brings down tyrants, that brings down systems and empires. And the way I see it, it's just that we're the people and the protests and all of it is part of entropy really practicing itself through us. The whole system and all of these tyrant figures, like the whole predication of it is on order, control. And you can't, no order, no control can ever be had forever, essentially. Eventually, the entropy, the entropic nature of what is, pulls it apart, breaks it down. So, and that, I guess, also seeps that empirical urge to control, that tyranny, that's what seeps into our relationships. Right? I want to control the situation. I want to know, what are your intentions? How far do you want to go? Do they match my intentions? Ukhti, what if your intentions change tomorrow? What if something happens next week and it totally shatters your world? What about the intentions you set and you forced this person to set with you, and all this stress, this thing that you did and all? Mm. Oh, what do you do with it? How are you so sure? Like,
no room for the chaos.
Yeah, legit.
Yeah, empire being order and the natural order of things being order and chaos. Mm-hmm. Like, we were talking about how there is no truth, but maybe if there is a truth, it's the movement between order and chaos. Mm. And the dynamic of change. Mm.
It's the order of chaos, I think. Like, chaos has its own order somehow. Wherever there is a conscious agent, there will be some kind of order imposed from within, you know, like connecting the dots, like the stars are just dots in the sky, but we've decided, we've seen which ones travel together and we've connected them and we've imagined what they might look like if we trace them, and we've given them names and we've watched how they move and, you know, watch how they might affect us. This urge to create patterns, like, is part of it, right? To have some control, to see some sort of order in the way things are working, and then maybe making sense out of that and using that knowledge to better our lives, to better ourselves, which is fun. Like, part of being in a body, but then its shadow side is taking it too far, becoming tyrannical with that knowledge, not being able to play with it, not being able to accept that it won't really be quote-unquote accurate all the time. Sometimes it'll be fuzzy, it'll be, you know,
imperfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's, at the end of the day, it's everything that we have done for us to make our sense of what is. It's not actual truth. It's not truth, capital T, within itself, grasped of the essence. This is the essence. The tree is a tree because in its essence there's tree-ness. La. I don't
know. Just a word we made up.
Right. To just vaguely gesture towards that, towards an essence, essentially.
Mm.
So that we can categorize what is and isn't a tree. What is a plant? A tree is a plant, but not every plant is a tree. And
it blinds us from, you know, humans are only seeing like a tiny little billionth of the information that's available. I mean, maybe every human's different, but that's what language does to us and what stories do to us and what social agreements, like the justice system. Mm-hmm. It's just a social contract. We've decided, some people decided that it was real and it became real for all of us. Mm-hmm. But all of those things are human creations that then create this way we see the world. And yeah, naming the tree, all of a sudden you don't take in other information. It's locked in. It's an assumption that's real to you and your experience, and you can touch it, you can feel it, but it's so much messier than that. Mm. It's so much more complex than that. Mm. And like, we're learning now how to open the doors and see more, but I think the underlying fear and the grief that's still being moved through, because the awareness, the opening, the witnessing of it comes with so much grief that needs to be moved.
It's new for a lot of us. It's overwhelming. Can't even imagine what it would be like to start seeing this just now as an adult, not having any awareness whatsoever about what's going on. And now we grew up knowing what's going on. We grew up calling it Palestine. We grew up knowing that we weren't allowed to talk about it in America or in Canada. So,
well, and for, so though, like, I think there's a real invitation for people who are grieving and witnessing for the first time and opening up to that to let it move through them and not get stuck in that victim place and not take it on and recognize the privilege of the comfort that they have access to be able and to not fear the grief.
And to let it fuel your lust for life in your relationships, especially in your job. Because if for the people who have skills, have dreams, have little talents, have the idea of maybe I don't have to be doing this 9-to-5 thing, maybe I could be doing that. You could be doing that. You could, actually. And soon I think a lot more of us could be doing what we want if we have the courage, essentially. Again, to not withhold your love, like not to withhold your love from yourself, from your relationships, from the people in your life, forgetting the transaction, letting go, essentially, of that transactional need. What are you bringing to the table? What are you doing? What are you doing for me? What value are you adding to my life? Khalas, the waiter is bringing the food to the table. You guys get to just enjoy what's at the table and get to know one another. And figure out if this person is valuable to you in no tangible way, just energetically. Hey, in their presence, are they valuable to you? Do you feel good in this person's presence? Do you want them in your presence? Continue to have them. If you do, don't withhold your love. Let them know that you enjoy their presence, essentially. And I think what's really interesting, like, we're mainly speaking to hetero relationships, because I think queer relationships are have that raised consciousness. Like, queer people are much better at communicating with one another and communicating their love to one another reaffirming and making one another feel safe in the space when they want to bring up something, speak about something. Like, they're really good at really utilizing the masculine and the feminine energies to show up for one another in fullness, essentially. And what's really interesting too in my research, one thing that I'm finding, and this is so funny because so many Zionists like to bring up queerdom. It's like, oh, if you were gay, if you were queer and you went to Gaza, they would kill you, blah, blah. Queerdom is actually like probably one of the greatest anti-colonial things we can do today. Like, in itself is resistance, and two is also really deeply connected to Palestinian political identity today, the identity of young people, of the more liberal side, the musical youth group, youth culture side of Palestinian resistance. Queerdom is a big part of that, and queer activism and queer rights. And this was also part of the talk that I gave 2 days ago, in how queerdom can expand the limits that occupational aggression puts on your imagination. The affect of queerdom, the bravery of it, the energy of it, the life lust, the lust for life, I guess, of it, can even be infectious. Like, if you're not queer, you're in Palestine and you have a queer sibling or a queer friend, like even that energy can fuel your own sense of liberation. It is an act of liberation in itself, essentially. Like, you know the guy who sang, Ana dammi Falastini, Falastini, that one, it kind of went like viral. The guy who won Arab Idol, he was a Palestinian guy from Gaza, Muhammad Asif. That was his name. She passed away. His sister was queer, or had like a queer affect in a sense. She was like kind of a tomboy, what we'd call a tomboy, and she was rebellious, and she really influenced him to follow his dreams. Like really inspired him, and her way of being inspired him to eventually go on Arab Idol and sing and eventually win and like come to be like this symbol of hope for Palestinians, for Gazans and for Palestinians as a whole. Because you don't get to dream in Gaza, and to see someone from Gaza live a dream can just like for a moment just really expand the horizon for you. Like, it can create this whole new sense of hope and possibility and space for imagination. Like, and all of that in a way goes back to Noor, his sister, and how she kind of like, she pushed them to start a band as kids, and then she pushed him to practice and go sign up and go to Arab Idol. And yeah. What were you? I don't know how I got here. But.
Well, it's a perfect place to wrap up. It's, you know, following your dreams, being expansive, not living within the rules. Like, I think queerness to me is like, it's such a wonderful world because people, you're like, oh, well, then how do you define yourself? It's just like, just queer. There's no definition beyond that. I mean, people can identify as however they want. Mm-hmm. That's the beauty, power of choice. But like, to be in the nebulous openness instead of in the box that is like confirmed and like set. So just for all of us, the invitation to open and to follow our dreams and to express.
And love, not withhold your love, not withhold our love. Just in general, like whatever that means to you, however that manifests.
My friend said to me the other day, wherever you're at, take one step further. And if everyone, just wherever you're at, just take one step further. Speaking up, speaking out, being yourself, taking the risk of being yourself, taking the risk of speaking up, like you will be rewarded. We will, the collective.
It's beautiful.
To the dream space.
Oof.
Thank you for watching. I'm Kelly. This is a Dream Space practice session. It's all practice.
Hi.
Yeah. Shall we pull one card from this deck just to wrap it up? This is the Voyager Tarot deck. And when I moved into the place I'm living right now, my housemate had it. And I love it because it has the collages on it, and it also has the words on the Minor Arcana, but they're so different from the words on the Thoth Minor Arcana. Like, for example, Six of Cups in the Thoth deck is pleasure, and Six of Cups in this deck is sorrow.
Oh, wow. That's beautiful. There's actually one of the people in my alchemy course. His name is Atta. He's been using playing cards to
nice.
As the suits. He's been focusing on the Minor Arcana, and he's renamed them, and I think it's the pentacles that he calls sorrow.
Whoa.
I believe. Yeah, it's a really interesting way of looking at them.
Sorrow.
Ooh. There she is.
Oh, wow.
Ooh. Purity.
Mm.
Where should I point this? This one or the other
one? You can hold it closer to you. Mm. Little two of wands. That's nice.
Beautiful. It looks like he's burning a window, lighting a candle up against a window.
Let's see. Lighting a candle up against a window. Huh. Mm. Oh. Little nine of sorrow. Wait.
Narrowness.
Narrowness.
Mm. I always have such trouble with the cards that have names on them.
I know, and you've taught that like it totally just shuts down the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, and I've stopped working with the Thoth deck. Well, not stopped entirely, but like it's got a whole bunch of stuff going for it. But I think it's interesting when you study them across decks and then you get all these different perspectives, mm-hmm. but not to get locked into that, because all of a sudden it's just like, well, this is what it is, when really it's about telling a story and letting it come through you, which is what you teach.
Yeah. Really trying to play with it. The images.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll dig into this more next time.
Mm-hmm. Salish Seas. What are the Salish Seas?
The sea here, the ocean.
Oh, wow, the Pacific.
Area. Yeah, this area of the Pacific.
Is that enough? Is like acknowledging and bringing back the names, like, does that actually do justice?
We say it's out of respect. Mm-hmm. But how much of it is just distraction by the state to make us feel as if we've made real change when we haven't?
Let's say 50 years from now, 100 years from now, Israel takes Palestine, and it's over, and it's the Zionist state, the Jewish state, and they suddenly have this resurgence, this guilt, this, oh, we need to give back. These same people are then renaming the towns back to what their names were, but are they bringing the people back? The people who would have used this name?